I know milling my own flour is better and I want to do it, but where do I start? Home milling can be such a joy, and we're here in this episode to guide you through all the hows. We'll talk the multiple benefits of milling at home and fill in any gaps in knowledge you may have. We'll explain how you can grind a grain, what mills are available for your kitchen, and the benefits of each one. Then I'll share how I mill at home, the organisation around it, and what I make. And stay till the end, as we'll also squeeze in a chat about how home-milled flour is different to shop-bought and how you can best work with this amazing foodstuff in your own kitchen. Welcome to the Ancestral Kitchen Podcast with Alison, a European town dweller in central Italy, and Andrea, living on a newly created family farm in northwest Washington State, USA. Pull up a chair at the table and join us as we talk about eating, cooking, and living with ancient ancestral food wisdom in a modern world kitchen.
Hello, Alison. Good afternoon. Good morning. Yeah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good, thank you. And you?
I am also well. I'm a little chilly. Ooh. That's fine.
Okay.
Got some fuzzy blankets wrapped around me.
Always handy. Always handy. Have you had some breakfast this morning? Yep.
I did. I had, we just hard-boiled a ton of eggs this past week.
I saw all your eggs on Discord.
I had egg salad.
Yeah.
Yeah, even more. I think the kids are gathering about 40 a day right now.
Wow.
So it's crazy. But we made egg salad and I had some of that. My mom made some loaves of bread for us. And so I had egg salad on bread and a glass of water. It was what I wanted. So that's what I had.
Some days it goes like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And you, I'm sure you ate lunch. It's late for you.
Yeah.
What did you have?
We did. Gabe was at home because it's holiday. And I did separate
another
food.
One? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I did separate food for them.
Always.
Because I'm eating a very low histamine at the moment. So for the boys, there was some chicken soup in the freezer that I'd made previously with chicken, mushroom, cream and broth, which I freeze in little... little one cup portions. And so I got two of those out last night for the boys. And then I had two fried eggs with fried sweet potato. I cut it into little coins and put it in the cast iron pan with lard and cauliflower. And I did a ton of cauliflower. And then I just put another portion into the soup for Gabriel and for Rob. Yeah. And so they had like extra cauliflower and I had one on my plate.
Sounds really good.
Delicious. I love cauliflower.
Really Gosh, good. I don't think I've ever put cauliflower in chicken soup.
Yeah.
Now that you said that.
Gabriel loved it. Well, he loves the chicken soup.
I don't.
So he'll eat anything. Oh. But he loves cauliflower too, actually.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
So it went down really well.
Didn't you say Rob wasn't sold on cauliflower in the beginning?
But yeah, now he's a complete convert. Yeah, complete
convert. It's so funny because you were just saying in the Discord, oh yeah, well, Rob actually likes cod liver oil.
Yeah.
Like the flavor of it. But here, and he's like, the cauliflower? Yeah. I don't know.
Exactly. You got a spoonful of cod liver oil or cauliflower. Yeah, I'll take the cod liver oil, please.
Explain yourself.
Maybe one day I'll get him on here to explain himself.
So before we started, I was going to read a review that we got on the podcast. I'm just going to read part of it because it was a nice one and a long one, but I'm just going to read a part of it. We recorded an two-part episode a little while back, the 50 ways to save money within your ancestral food living.
Yes.
And this was a comment that we got from Jay Lynn Hooley.
Yeah.
I think I'm reading that right.
Yeah.
And the title was, "What a Great Double Episode." So Jay Lynn Hooley says, "If I download the list of 50 things, there would be a lot of checks." So, yeah, we must be thinking along the same lines. "You are so right about these things, as I do work on a farm for meat, eggs, and veggies. I have found a great niche at farmers markets by helping out with sales for the beginning rush in exchange for food. They don't need me the whole time. I can testify to that experience at farmers markets. And I have created a sourcing list for each food I put up. Like you, I say yes to everything, but especially to B-grade things at markets. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. Love that. And I love that you loved the episode, Jalen Hooley, because those are all things that Allison and I, or both of us, one or the other, both of us have found very useful. So
if anyone hasn't got that download yet, she talked about the download of the 50 things. It's on our website, which is ancestralkitchenpodcast.com. And just go to downloads and you can find it right at the top and you can download that list for yourself.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Or if you have somebody who, you know, wants to join you on the quest and wants some tips for saving money.
Yeah, you can give it to them.
It would be good for them too. Exactly. Yeah, it's good. I think it's a good one if you're already neck deep in the ancestral food, and it's a good one if you're just kind of starting out.
Yeah.
You know, either way, there should be something on there that's useful. So
I agree. If you're into ancestral eating, you'll know that liver is a superfood. Full of vitamin A, K, and a whole host of B vitamins, plus many essential minerals, it has a truly exceptional nutrient profile and is a staple of traditional healthy diets. But it's not always as easy to get liver into our lives as we want. Getting a good supply, knowing how to cook it so it actually tastes good, and getting all of our family to eat it. These things can be hard, especially when we're busy or traveling. That's where Andrea and I turn to liver capsules. They give us the incredible benefits of liver without having to worry about the sourcing, the preparation, or the eating. One Earth Health produces organ capsules from 100% grass-fed New Zealand-raised cattle. As a podcast listener, you can get 5% off and free shipping by using the link oneearthhealth.com/ancestral kitchen. And each time you order, you'll also be supporting us to keep on making the podcast. Details and the link are in the show notes.
Speaking of saving money, Allison, this episode is kind of going to hit on something that can save people a lot of money, especially since so many of our listeners are making a lot of their baked things at home. So this is something that you kind of went down the rabbit hole on, and then some of us in the Patreon were like, please tell us a little bit more. So,
yeah.
Can you introduce the topic?
Of course, I can. We are talking about home milling today, and do stay to the end because after we've talked about all the hows and whys and wherefores of home milling, we will also talk about how home milled flour is different than shop bought flour when the rubber hits the road and you are making bread in your kitchen.
Okay. So, okay. Now, I know you, and I know that something sends you off on these discoveries. So what started this for you?
Yeah.
The home milling.
Yeah, you do know me, that once I start with something, I'm like, right, blah, 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 and I'm gone down a rabbit hole completely. So yeah, a few months ago, I took the plunge and bought my own mill. And I've been thinking about it for a very, very long time, but not actually done it. And listeners may have heard back in episode 70, that was a while back now, which was our fermenting oats episode, me talk about
it's a good one.
The reason that pushed me over the edge in that episode and buying that mill, which I bought a mock mill 100. So that's really where this has come from. And I've been playing with that mill now for 6 months and doing amazing things with it and making amazing bread with it. And I wanted to share with listeners, because I know we get a lot of questions about milling and mills and the difference between them and working with home milled flour and whether it's worth it buying a mill. So I'm going to touch on all of those things and more. And you'll kind of hear my story a bit more about why I did it as we go through the different reasons. And the first question that I thought listeners might have is why mill your own flour. And I tried to distill that, the reasons why I think that's a good thing to do, and I've come up with four kind of categories. So we've got health, flavour, economy, and connection. And starting with health, because really that was my number one reason for getting that mock meal. We eat bread a lot in our family. You know, it's not something that we're just having once a week. We're eating it every day. And because bread is a food that we're eating every day, it feels really important to me that it's as healthy and as nutrient dense as it possibly can be. And I remember reading Weston Price's book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, a while ago. And some of the cultures in there, not all of them, use grains. In that book, there is no mention of sourdough, fermenting, anything like that. And that could be because it's just assumed that everyone did sourdough, but there's no specific mentions of it. But what there is so much emphasis on how traditional cultures he visited that used grains freshly ground that grain. And he talks throughout the visits to different cultures of that, but he also talks at the end, whenever he talks about grain products, he talks about them being freshly ground. It's really a focus. So I'd read that and kind of felt how important that was in the work that he did. And then I read a study by a guy called Bernasek, which was published in 1970. And I'm going to quote something, which there'll be a link to in the show notes, so you can go and kind of look it up if you want. But that study was on some rats, and those rats were fed carbohydrate in the form of flour or bread. So let me read a summary of it. Rats were fed diets consisting of 50% flour or bread. Group 1 consumed fresh stone ground flour. Group 2 was fed bread made with this flour. Group 3 consumed the same flour as group 1, but after 15 days of storage. Group 4 was fed bread made with the flour fed to group 3. A fifth group consumed white flour. After 4 generations, only the rats fed fresh stone ground flour, and those fed the bread made with it maintained their fertility. The rats in groups 3 to 5 had become infertile. 4 generations for rats is believed to be the equivalent of 100 years in humans. And that study, like when I shared it with you first of all, Andrew, I mean, it blew me away. It's just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of grim.
Yeah, actually. Very grim. So frankly, just the groups that were fed freshly stone ground flour and bread made with that maintain the fertility. The groups that weren't, even the ones that were fed the flour after 15 days of storage, became infertile.
Right.
And that just, it just made me stop and think, oh my gosh. And you know, I remember when we did our interview with Marcus Patchett, the chocolate guy, way, way back, he talked about fairy dust in chocolate. And it was kind of a joking term, but he meant it in terms of all those tiny little things that are amazing and that are in chocolate. And I feel like it's the kind of the same thing here with bread. You know, we think of the starch, the carbohydrate, and we know that there are things in those grains that are not as prevalent in our heads as the starch that do good things. But I really think there's just a myriad of tiny sort of chemicals and particles that do things, and that when we grind that grain and expose those to oxygen, they degrade. And we are losing whatever goodness they can impart to us when we leave our flour on the shelf and let those things just go into the air because they're oxidizing, or, you know, degrade because they're oxidizing. And it feels like the equivalent of that fairy dust in, you know, in beautiful chocolate. That flour, when it's freshly ground, has these amazing properties that if we want our diets to be as nutrient dense as possible, and we're eating bread a lot, which my family are, then capturing those and baking them into bread is a great thing to do. So when I read that, it sent me kind of diving into a bit more deeply, you know, what happens when we leave flour on the shelf after we've ground it. And, you know, we know that vitamins and minerals are lost. They literally go down. And what was important in that fermenting oats episode I did is that phytase, which is the compound that neutralizes phytic acid in grains. Remember that phytic acid is the thing that can stop you absorbing minerals like calcium. Phytase neutralizes phytic acid, and phytase is lost when you leave flour out on the shelf. So for example, rye, that, as you know, I work with a lot, that has high levels of phytase. Wonderful to put into oats, which don't have high levels of phytase. But if you're using rye flour that's been sat on a shelf for really not long, I mean, that study said 15 days, but
less than 2 weeks.
My research has shown much less than that. You're not going to have that phytase anymore. We also know that fats oxidize when they're exposed to air. And so therefore that's going to cause potentially whole grain flour to go rancid. And we just don't know. I mean, when you buy shop-bought flour, you don't know how long ago it was milled. You don't know how long it has been on the shelf. You know, it's an impossible thing to try and get your head around.
Yeah.
And yeah, go on.
Even with the, I'm thinking of the leavened and unleavened bread, you know, that the Bible talks about.
Yeah.
And even the unleavened bread wouldn't be all phytic acid rich necessarily, because they probably would have just ground it.
Yeah.
Or it'd have completely. The phytase in it.
Completely. They would have just ground it and then put it onto a hot stone and cooked it.
Wouldn't be costing their body that extra effort.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And of course, you know, there aren't many studies on this, because really people don't stand to make a great deal of money by studying this. So there aren't many studies. But like I said, I'm sure there are a lot more things that we don't even understand that are being lost in the process of putting flour on a shelf. So that's, in my opinion, compelling health reasons to mill your own flour. And the reason I chose a mock mill really was partially for health. We'll talk about the types of mills that are available a bit later, but the idea of stone milling your own flour, just like Western Price talked about, it was freshly stone ground flour, takes the idea of milling as far as possible down the health kind of path, because if you stone mill, the grain isn't overly heated during that process. So as we know, the more you heat things, the more likely it is that compounds are going to be killed. And so when you stone grind flour, you are keeping it cooler than the potential other options. And so therefore the grain's going to be less damaged.
I did not know that. That was the draw with the stone.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's, you know, one of the things I did when I researched the mock mill was I looked up, you know, how hot does this flour get during the milling process?
Of course you did.
I did. I was like, I have to know this.
This is why I just wait for you to buy things, Alison.
So
after Alison buys it, then I'll get it.
I know the difference between what temperature you will get your flour out of a mock mill compared to what temperature you get your flour out of a Vitamix, if you do it that way or if you do it some other way. So
it gets really hot in the Vitamix.
Yeah. So
yeah,
it's important.
Yeah. Which the Vitamix is fantastic if you actually want to make soup in it, because you can actually cook
your soup. Yeah, cook your soup. But, exactly.
And if you're in a real pinch, you can grind, you know, a cup of cornmeal or something. But yeah, if you do very much flour in there, it's going to get...
Yeah, completely. So those are my health reasons, really, for choosing to purchase a mock mill. The second reason why you might want to mill at home is for flavour. And I kind of knew that everyone talked about this before I bought the mill. I thought, yeah, well, we'll get bread that tastes better as well. That'll be an extra bonus. That's how it felt to me. But then, having tasted the bread since getting the mill, it is completely different. I mean, like, seriously. And you can sort of draw a parallel, even if you haven't tried this yourself at home, because we all know what it's like to have properly fresh food. I mean, if you're growing a vegetable or carrot in your back garden and you go pull it and bring it in and cook it and compare the flavour of that carrot to vegetables in a plastic bag from a supermarket, there is no comparison. And we've all tried that and kind of know that. And it works the same way with grains. When you make bread with flour that you've freshly ground, it really is fresh. I mean, you can keep those grains for years in the state they are. And archaeologists have found grains, I know, on digs and been able to sprout them, like, you know, centuries later. So you really, you can have those grains in your house and yet have them fresh in the same way as you could just pull a carrot from your garden. And the flavour of them, when you do that, I mean, the two grains that we use, as you know, mostly in this house are rye and spelt. And, you know, rye is that sort of deep, rich, sweet flavour. And it's even sweeter when you freshly mill it. It's just, it's got more depth, it's got more zing, it's got more sweetness. And spelt is well known for being a kind of a nutty flavour. And spelt is even nuttier when you freshly grind it. So it's like the characteristics of the grain are amplified through freshly grinding. It's just, the flavour is amazing.
And you know, we both know, Alice, and our listeners know that when you have fresh food that has those extra flavours, the flavour actually signals something.
Yeah, completely.
The flavour isn't just a chemical additive from a company placed in there that will never expire, that's there to make you think you're eating something.
Mm.
Yeah. The flavor is the plant telling you something that's beneficial for you. And so if you're tasting something in the spelt that's more delicious, that means there's something really good in there that you're not getting out of your aged flour.
Yeah, completely, completely. So number three in our list of why you might want to home mill your flour is economy. And we've talked about this several times on the podcast, and there are details of it in my spelt book. Generally, if you buy grains, they're cheaper than flour. And the good thing about buying grains is that you can buy them in bulk. It's really not very easy to buy flour in bulk. Before we had the mock mill, we did do it. We didn't buy in as much bulk as we do now with grains. But we did buy flour in bulk, and then we used to take it out, put it in separate bags, keep it in the freezer. I've got a tiny freezer, so we couldn't do much at a time, and it took up like virtually like half of the room of the freezer. So you can buy flour in bulk, but it's not so easy. And also, like I said earlier, if it's whole grain and you're not able to freeze it, it's likely that the fats in that grain are potentially going to go rancid the longer you leave it. Whereas grains, you can buy in bulk and you can store them for ages. And so grains are cheaper to start with. And then when you buy 25 kilos, which is it's like £50 for you, I think, in the States, you can get really good deals on them, something like that.
Yeah. Isn't it weird that, once again, the best thing for you is actually the most economic?
Yeah, back to 50 ways to save money.
That's not what we're told by the media. We're told by the media, you can't afford to eat really good. It's too expensive for you.
Yeah.
It's actually the cheapest.
Yeah, exactly. You have to buy this kombucha from the store that costs like, you know, $9 for a tiny bottle and it's all really sugary. No.
You could just start with, you have to buy this at the store.
Yeah. I didn't even need to go any further than that, did I? So when you buy grains like that, like I said, you can store them for ages. Now, we did interview Ellie from Ellie's Everyday, who is someone we love here at the podcast, back in episode 42, How to Get and Grind the Best Flour for Bread. In there, she shares her storage routine for grains, which includes kind of putting them in the freezer. So if there's any weevils in them, you won't have problems with that. We buy them in bulk, and we have frozen some of them. We haven't frozen some of them. We're storing them, and it's much, much cheaper. So my kind of suggestion for listeners there is to look up at wherever you get your grains or wherever you can get your grains locally. Look up how much the flour costs. Look up how much the equivalent of grains cost and do a comparison. Look up then if you buy five times that amount of grains, because usually you can buy massive sacks. See how much that costs and work out how much different it makes to your bread. And then if you're worried about the cost of the meal I've bought, I mean, basically I'm not going to buy another meal for the rest of my life. That's my plan. So think about how the cost of that meal then works out over, you know, 5 years, a decade, 15 years of buying bulk grains rather than flour. And really, it's a no-brainer. It is.
Yeah, Gabriel probably, I mean, unless he moves farther away from you and he wants to grind his flour, you won't even have to buy milk. He can just keep using yours.
Yeah, exactly. He can be using it. It's an heirloom. My family heirloom. So the last one, again, kind of a bit like the flavour. This was a kind of an aside when I bought my meal. I didn't really think about it before the mock meal. But I did feel like, you know, deep down there was a drive for me to get closer and closer to my food. You know, that's what my journey's been since I started eating ancestrally. That's what both of us has been, you know, that's why you have your farm and part of it, and why you're going to develop your garden, and why you've got animals. So we both know, and listeners know, that the closer we get to our food source, the more fulfilling and satisfied we become. And seeing those grains being turned into flour by me whenever I want in my kitchen just connects me more and more to the grain and the soil that grew the grain and the farmer that grew the grain. It makes me question more. It's like, you know, getting out of a supermarket. When you start to do that, you start to question, well, where did my meat come from? And I bought this meat from this farmer. How is he growing it? What is he feeding his animals? The same thing has happened with the grains. I feel when I'm grinding those grains for my family's bread, I feel a much deeper sense of contentment over changing that grain into flour. And I feel a connection with the food stuff and how it's going to nourish our bodies. I feel a connection with the grain more. And I start to think about the grass it's, you know, grown as, and how that looks in fields and what it does to the soil and the crop rotation and all of these things that I just are more easy to avoid when you buy flour. And on the flip side, the deeper you get into them, the more gratitude springs forth, the more desire to connect springs forth. And I think feels to me like a really big part of milling at home. It kind of makes something more circular, and I like that.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful.
So, yeah, those are the four things. So we had health, which was most important for me, flavour, economy, and connection. And then I've got something that just quite funny that I wanted to share, Andrew, which I told you about before we started, which I've shared before.
Yeah, you told me this, and it shook me.
Yeah.
I was so surprised.
So everyone,
I love it.
Everyone knows, really, listening. I mean, this is what our ancestors did. There weren't great big steel roller mills grinding grain, you know, centuries ago. Our ancestors used, first of all, as you were saying, mortar and pestle to grind grain into flour. And then querns came into use. And querns were stone mills that were rotary and hand turned. So they had, some of them had a kind of a handle on the top, which you turned in a circle with one stone on top of the other. Some of them had animals that did that. So querns came into use in the 3rd century before Christ. And it is really interesting. If you dive back into the use of querns in those societies, it was mostly the women that did the grinding. So some of them sometimes two of them would sit opposite each other. So because the querns were quite big and they needed one person to be able to kind of pull the handle from one side and the other one to take it when it went right over to the other side of the circle. And there's a quote here that prehistoric women that lived in Central Europe during the first 5,500 years of farming had stronger upper arm muscles than living female rowing champions. And oh, I just think that's amazing. You know, we see rowers and the female rowers, and we think about the training that they do every day with their arms, mm-hmm. turning those oars. And yet, that was normal for women who were living in prehistoric times, probably because of querns, because it was their job to grind the grain. And they needed to do it a lot, because you've got to turn a quern quite a few times to get the grain out to make a loaf of bread. And it's part of the physicality and their health as well, which I thought was, it's just amazing, that statistic.
And the fact that they compared it to the rowers is interesting, because I actually had looked up female elite rowers after you told me that. And I read on a college website that rowing is considered one of the most physically demanding endurance sports in the world.
Gosh. Wow. So making querns was more demanding than the most physically demanding endurance sports in the world. Wow.
Hey, you washing the dishes. Been there. You've heard Allison and I talk over and over about her love of rye sourdough bread. Well, I might actually call it an obsession, but that's neither here nor there. Now you can make Allison's rye sourdough in your own kitchen with her as your teacher. And she's a really good teacher. Rye is economical, it's delicious, and full of nutrients and low in gluten. There's a reason why it has been a darling of bread bakers for centuries. Make it into sourdough, as Allison will show you in her course, Rye Sourdough Bread, Mastering the Basics. And you've got an amazing, tasty, and nutritious staple in your kitchen. It's traditional and it's nutritional. In this course, you'll learn everything there is to know about how she creates and maintains her rye sourdough starter, all about whole grain sourdough rye, including the key differences between baking with rye and wheat, how to make two loaves, an everyday rye sandwich bread, and a delicious Russian-style dark rye loaf, and what to do with your sourdough discard, including video walkthroughs for sourdough pancakes and a tasty, sweet, spiced cake. Head to www.ancestralkitchen.com/rye.
Okay, so let's talk about mill options now. Andrea, do you want to clarify anything or stop me before I just go into this one?
No, I'm really curious about this part, because this is the aspect that I actually know the least about.
Okay.
Is the choices between mills. So okay. I really want to hear
Brilliant.
What you have to say here.
Okay, so before I even had anything that really could grind grain, I used to blend grain. So what I used to do, I made buckwheat bread back in the day, and I used to soak the buckwheat and leave it overnight. And then I used to put it in a food processor or a blender and just blend it up and make a batter with it.
Oh, like wet?
Yeah, and make a batter bread from it. So, you know, you can do that if you're just kind of starting out and you want to play around with whole grains. But you will get a batter, so you can use it for pancakes, or you can make a kind of a batter style bread. Generally, if you want to purchase a mill to grind your grain dry, the choices that you're going to have put in front of you are an impact mill, the types of mill, impact mill, a roller mill, or a stone mill. And you'll see those terms kind of put around in all of the mills that you look up. So impact mills use impact. That's why they're called impact mills. To break up grains. So they smash grains against the side of a container in order to make them into flour. So an example of this is the Nutrimill, and that one is small and it's cheaper than the other options of roller or stone mill. So that's one of the benefits of it. But it does grind up at high temperatures. A bit like you were saying, Andrea, you know, you can use a Vitamix. That's a similar kind of idea. The Vitamix is using blades in it, and it's smashing the grain against the side and smashing them against the blades. And it will absolutely pulverize your grain into a flour. But in doing so, it will increase the temperature of your grain. But if you just want to have a go and start, that's it. Or if you really don't have any space at all and you want something very small, you're not making bread perhaps so often, that's a good option. Now, so that's an impact mill. A roller mill is rollers that are aligned together with a very small gap in between them, and the grain goes in between those rollers and is squashed. So we actually do have a roller mill here in this house, and that's our Marcato Marga. I bought that about 5 years ago, and we use that a lot for rolling oats. So a roller mill, you can, if you get one that has different variations on it, you can change that gap between the space between the two rollers. So you can say, I just want, for example, to roll my oats, and then you'll leave a slightly larger gap between the two rollers by changing the settings. You can put your oats through that and it will just flatten them. Or on the Marcato Marga, we can then change the settings to be a thinner gap and put those oats through again, and they will disintegrate literally after a few goes. Used to grind rye in the Marcato Marga, but it doesn't grind as finely as it would do in a stone mill, for example. Oh, Marcato,
just putting it over and over.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So our Marcato Marga is hand crank. You can get engines for them.
Go Rob.
Put on, but yeah, there you go. So Rob used to literally put that rye grain in it and put it on the wider setting, and then take it all out, put it back in, put it on a smaller setting, put it through again, and then take it all out, put it on a smaller setting, put it through again. Even after those kind of three goes, we would be left with really quite coarsely ground rye flour. So,
and a half an afternoon, probably kind of messy.
And strong arm muscles.
But good memories. Good memories.
Yeah. Well, he used to read when he was doing it to Gabriel and I.
Oh, I love that.
So we used to do it in the evening and like make a big thing of it. He would set up, you know, something, a book on the side so he could see it quite easily. And then he'd just read away and grind away. So, not so good if you don't have strong arms like me. If you do, and
how much time,
and you have spare time and you want a kind of real hand experience of it, then that's an option. Yeah. Now, it's perhaps slightly confusing because in an industrial setting, there are roller mills, and most flour that you find on the supermarket shelf today has been ground in a roller mill. Roller mills were introduced in the 1800s and replaced stone mills, and they basically did that because they could grind more flour and make more money and get as much white flour as possible out of the grains. So if you are buying flour, I know we're talking about milling now, but if you are buying flour, if you want to be sure that you're getting the best possible flour that you can, look for a packet that says stone ground. If it doesn't say that, absolutely positively it's been roller milled, which means its temperatures have been taken up. And probably if it's whole grain and roller milled, it's actually been, there's been white flour and the bran's been added back into it, because the roller mills all have sieves and separators. And I think I'd probably just feel absolutely depressed if I went to a roller mill and looked at it, a roller mill factory.
That's like milk, Alison.
Yeah.
That's the same thing with milk. There's no, like, they don't actually sell you whole milk. It's,
they put it back in,
separated, and then put back together.
There we go.
Very scientific.
Yeah, but not very real. So that's roller mills. And then the third one, so we had impact, roller, we're onto stone mills now. So stone mills are mills that use stones to grind the flour. And my mock mill that I'm using is a stone mill. So the first thing that I did when I got the mock mill was literally take it apart, because, you know, why not? I wanted to see what was inside. And it's actually really easy to take apart. You don't have to take it apart very much afterwards. I haven't taken it apart since then, because even if you make a doozy and put something in it that is a bit too sticky and shouldn't have gone through it, you can usually just put a dry grain through the hopper and run it again and it cleans itself. So I haven't had to open it since then. But I opened it when it first arrived because I wanted to look at it. And it is two very precise, round, beautiful, heavy stones that are sitting on a kind of a spring, one on top of another. And then the mock mill has a lever on the side, which has numbers on it that go from 1 to 10. And you slide that lever from numbers 1 to 10. And as you do that, those two stones get further and further apart. So if I want to have my flour as thin and finely ground as possible, I'm going to use one. But if I want to grind a grain that has, for example, more fat, like oats, I'm not going to put it on one, because probably that fat's going to clog up in between that very tiny gap. So I'll put it on five, maybe a bit further. If I want to have my flour a bit less finely ground, I can push that lever back as well. But basically, a stone mill, even though it's small, I mean, the mock mill is not big. It is two stones. So it's exactly the same technology as that quern that our prehistoric ancestors were using. But it's just been packaged in this way that we can use it in a modern kitchen. So as I said, the stone mills, mock mill is the one that I have. Como are another famous make of stone mills. They have temperatures that keep the grain lower, so they don't heat it up as much. So those are the types of grain mills, the different ways of grinding. I wanted to talk a little bit about the actual machines that you can get for your home kitchen. So go back to a kind of another example. Perhaps you have a KitchenAid in your kitchen and you're very happy with it. You can buy an attachment for that KitchenAid that will grind grain for you. I remember when I looked at this as an option, I don't have a KitchenAid, but you know, I wanted to explore all the options. I remember reading that you've got to make sure you've got a powerful KitchenAid, one of the more powerful ones, because grinding grain is an intensive task and you could blow the motor on your KitchenAid if you don't have a really kind of expensive one.
Yeah.
So that's an example of an attachment. And I think some of the other food processors have attachments that can grind grain for you. So,
Remember, right, Alison, we asked in Discord how many people have the KitchenAid attachment, didn't we?
Yeah.
And a couple of people said, I have it and I don't like it. I don't think it got rave reviews.
Okay. I don't.
And maybe it's, I don't know if it's because they don't have the, you know, if you have a standard KitchenAid model, it's probably not
strong enough,
beefy enough, or if they just didn't like the grind that came out. But it didn't seem like people were mad about the attachment.
Yeah. I think I remember Diana saying that actually. So yeah.
Yeah. And I don't remember where the conversation exactly happened, but it was something where we concluded that, you know, if you have something that you're doing quantity of, you need the tool that's for the thing.
Yeah, I agree. So other than attachment, the type of mill you can buy for your home, for your kitchen, is a standalone mill. So some standalone mills are impact mills. So the Nutrimill Classic is an impact standalone mill. Some standalone mills are stone, like the mock mill. So I love the mock mill because of the stone ground benefits that you get from it. But you know, wherever you are in your journey, if you want to move forward, then it's, you know, as we know, we go for whatever we are able to move on to at that point. And so, you know, for years and years I was using shop-bought flour. I was able to purchase a mock mill. But if you have access to a Nutrimill or you have access to a attachment for your KitchenAid and you want to have a go and you want to work with that until you're able to save up and afford to buy a stone mill, then do that. Each of those movements along the path is taking you further in your bread journey, which is a wonderful thing in my book, for sure. Okay, any questions on kind of those types and those ways of milling, Andrea, before I move on to talking about my mill?
No. I think that's very helpful because, again, I didn't really know much about the impact or stone ground difference, although I did hear you and Ellie talk about it, but I didn't really know why, other than that it sounds cooler.
Yeah, it sounds cooler too, doesn't it?
Stone which I guess ground literally is cooler.
Yeah.
But good to know.
Yeah.
So yeah, keep going.
Okay. So what I want to do now is talk about my mill and why I chose it and the good things about it and what you can do.
I do need to know this.
So I have a mock mill 100. Mock mills have various types of mills in speed and the type of housing. And my one has the vegetable cellulose housing. And the 100 in the title signifies that it can grind 100 grams, which is just over 4 ounces of grain in a minute. They also have a 200, which can go twice the speed. But I was like, oh, I don't mind. I'm happy waiting for my flour to come out. So I have the 100. The 100 is cheaper than the 200. So I, in the last 6 months, I absolutely love the mock mill. It's just, it's so easy. It's like I said, I've never had to open it. It's so clean, even if you mess up and put the wrong thing in, which I've done a few times. There's no fuss to it at all. Literally, it's so simple. You have your grain, you take the lid off the hopper, you turn the mill on, you select the right number that you want, which usually is 1 for me. You pour the grain in, comes out the other end. Just got a bowl to catch it at the other end. It's really lovely to look at as well. When I first bought it, I have a tiny kitchen, literally a tiny kitchen. When I first bought the mock mill, I thought this is going to be something that we swap in and out from the workspace because that's what we do with stuff because we have really don't have any room. We have storage space downstairs and then we swap things out. So sometimes we've got the food processor out. Sometimes we've got the slow cooker out. Sometimes I've got the dehydrator out. And I thought that the mock mill would become part of that kind of rotation, that we'd just get it out when we needed it and then put it in a space away. But it has stayed on my counter since I bought it 6 months ago. And that's partially because it's small and it's partially because it's lovely to look at because I don't like looking at things that are ugly, and it's not, it's beautiful. But partially also because I just use it all the time, literally. If we were to take it off my counter and put it somewhere and then bring it back, I would have to be doing that all the time. So I'm using it to grind rye to put with my porridge. I'm using it for non-gluten grains. I'm using it, you'll hear a bit later, I'll explain what I use it for, but I'm using it all the time. I use it much more than I thought I would. And I'm really happy for it to stay on the counter. It's, you want to say, Andrea, and just interrupt away.
No, I was just saying nice. I mean, I know you don't even have a counter.
Yeah, well, exactly. So. Yeah.
Exactly. I've seen it, so I know.
There's a video
that's pretty impressive
in the treasure trove for patrons that I took of my kitchen just to actually prove how tiny my kitchen was and that you could cook ancestrally in such a small space. So, yeah.
Patrons, yeah, in case anybody listening doesn't know, nobody who listens to the podcast is allowed to use the excuse, I don't have a big kitchen.
Yeah.
Therefore, I can't because Allison has a corner.
Exactly.
A table.
Exactly. So, it's also really versatile. That's the other thing that I wanted to say. It's really easy to switch that grain size. You can just literally turn the lever from 10 to 1. And then actually when it's on 10, you can unscrew the lever, bring it back to 1, and then push it another 10 steps out. So you can make the grind really, really wide. It's so, so versatile.
Wow, that's... So, like, if you wanted to do corn, could you do corn in it?
That's a really good question. I don't know that. I feel like I should have the mock meal book with me now. That's the one thing I haven't looked. Yeah, there's a book, yeah. Tells you all what you can grind and what numbers to do it on.
Well, okay, so what do you grind in?
Yeah, okay. Unfortunately, not corn yet. I feel like I have to go and try that now. So, spelt and rye. Listeners to the podcast will know that I have written a book for the podcast, Spelt Sourdough Every Day, which includes, I think, 11 of my wonderful spelt recipes. And that's up on the podcast website. So I grind my spelt in that. I also grind rye. Again, listeners to the podcast have probably heard us chat about my rye sourdough course, Mastering the Basics, which is over at the Fermentation School. I'm doing those all the time. Then, as I said, oats. We grind our oats in it. Not the same as rolling them. So I'm rolling them in the Mercato Marga, the hand roller mill, to get the oats that you kind of are used to seeing on the shelf, you know, flattened oats. You can also grind oats. And traditionally, until roller mills came in, so traditionally in Scotland, all oats were ground into, you know, a coarse flour or a medium flour. They weren't rolled. Rolled oats were not invented until the 1800s.
Wait, really?
Did you not know that?
How have I known you this long and I didn't know that?
Maybe you don't know that. Yeah.
Maybe you've told me before and I forgot.
Maybe.
But what?
Maybe, yeah. So all traditional oats were eaten in Scotland as oat meal,
so all those...
which means a meal, like, you know, a flour.
Mm. Okay, everybody who's read, you know, all these old George MacDonald books and stuff, now you have to repicture all those bowls of porridge.
They're not.
And get it right in your head. It wasn't flakes.
Yeah. Okay. So I do oats in there. I do millet and sorghum because I make a gluten and lectin-free bread regularly. We eat that almost every day. I do brown rice. I've lined tins with brown rice flour quite a lot, and I put brown rice in pancake mixes. I grind buckwheat, which you can, is high in phytase, and you can add to oats to neutralize the phytic acid instead of rye if you are gluten-free. And then very often
but they'd have to be fresh.
Yeah, freshly ground, exactly. So very often I'll freshly grind buckwheat and
the phytase is gone.
I'll just add it to my oats and then soak those oats. I found I've made pancakes quite a lot more since I've had the mock meal because literally I'll just open the cupboard and I'll see, look, I've got millet, I've got buckwheat, I've got this, I've got that, and I can grind it just then and there. It's really easy. I often grind a lot of flour or more flour. I'm not particularly bothered about weighing it. And then I'll just have containers and I'll keep the flour in the fridge after I've ground it, which I'll do for a week. I grind the flour for my sourdough starter. And that's just simple. You know, I only need a little bit. Well, I only get a few grains out. And I grind that. And then I'm refreshing my starter with it. So lots of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. Go on.
Yeah. No, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm also picturing that if you had a ritual, you know, millet, sorghum, buckwheat, teff combo that you always made, you could just pre-weigh and mix your whole grains in a jar.
Correct.
And then just
pour it in.
You know, and if you're doing things by weight anyways, not volume, then if you're weighing grains, that's the same weight of flour you'll have at the end.
Mm.
So you could just weigh out your portions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you sieve the flour that comes from the...
No, I haven't. You could, but I've never sieved the flour. I love the fact that the whole of it's in there, and I know it's completely fresh, and that bran and that germ has been just cracked just then. So I've never really felt the need to sieve it. And it's kind of a faff, as we would say over here, to sieve. So, no.
I mean, you have to basically flap flour around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And make a mess. And, especially because our kids love to help.
Yeah, exactly. And then it takes twice as long and it goes everywhere.
Right.
In our hair, too. You can do other grains. I've never done quinoa or amaranth in them. In the mock meal, but you can grind spices in it. And then if you are worried about the smell kind of transferring, you just put a little bit of brown rice through to clean the stones afterwards. I have ground chia in it, chia seed, and use that to thicken things. And I do know you can do legumes in it. So you just turn that lever to further than 10 in the way. I think Ellie's got a video on her channel that shows that. But literally you turn the lever to 10, unscrew it, put it back to 1, screw it up, turn it to 10 again. And you're basically on 20. And you can crack legumes in the stones that way. So, I mean, I'm sure you can do corn in it. I haven't looked, but I'm sure you can. I haven't found a grain that I want to grind that I can't grind in it. And I haven't exploited everything it can do yet. So it's a wonderful piece of machinery. How do you feel about our food world? Do you want to see change like we do? If so, head over to patreon.com/ancestralkitchenpodcast and help support us to get this work out as far and wide as we can. To say thank you, we've got a host of extra ancestral food material to share with you. You can connect with us more deeply via our Patreon exclusive podcasts, our after show chats, our dedicated forum, and our ancestral food get togethers. And there's a library of downloads that will support you in your own kitchen. By joining, you'll be really helping us to continue making this podcast and to focus on having a bigger impact, reaching more people, making a greater difference, so we can move together towards the future food world we all want to see. We've got 4 levels of support to suit different pockets. Check out www.patreon.com/ancestralkitchenpodcast for all the details. So if listeners would like to purchase a mock meal, I meant to say this in the previous section, we have kind of an affiliate set up with Mock Meal. So you can go and visit their site via my site, and I'll put a link in the show notes. I think, let me just look at my notes here because I do have it. I think it's ancestralkitchen.com/mill. And if you go there...
This was the perfect... Mm-hmm. This was the perfect sponsor for the podcast because you basically told them, we're going to talk about you no matter what, so you can send us a link if you want. Yeah. But you are already bound and determined on doing this episode. Yeah. It's like, well...
Completely.
Might as well send us a link. So that was awesome that they did. And
we have that link, kind of which will give you... If you click on that, if you go to that page, ancestralkitchen.com/mill, then you will find pictures of my meal and details of why I chose it. And if you click on any of the links in there that take you to Mock Meal, if you then go ahead and decide you want to take the plunge and get a meal like mine, then the podcast gets a little bit of a help, which is wonderful because it just helps us buy microphones and keep the shows rolling. Okay. Yes. So
yeah, I just double checked.
You did. It is mill.
Ancestralkitchen.com slash mill.
Thank you for checking that.
Just ancestralkitchen.com.
We'll put that in the show notes.
And yeah, make sure that
as well. Okay. Cool. So we are almost done now. We have 2 things still to talk about, and one of them we are going to, I think, shunt into an after show for the patrons because I'm looking at the clock and we're almost at time. So I want to talk about 2 things. The first one is how milled flour is different to store-bought flour and how to work with it. And then I think for the after show, for the patrons, I will talk about a question that I'm asked a lot, which is how can I convert recipes I see online for bread flour to use my whole grain flour?
Oh, good one.
So let's talk about the differences between milled flour and shop-bought flour first. And what I wanted to say was that this is an area that, excuse me, that I have worked with people one-on-one with, because it's something that if you're not used to using wholemeal flour and you've used white shop-bought flour before, it's quite a transition to move across. And sometimes people want some hand-holding. So I do have sourdough mentoring available if people want to come and work with me and open their kitchen up to my kitchen. I will put a link in the show notes for that as well. And I have a troubleshooting one-off option where we could just have one call together. Or I also have a package of four sessions where I could walk you through the whole process of making whole grain sourdough. Okay, so what's the difference between shop-bought flour and wholemeal flour? The first one is it's more thirsty. It needs more water. And it's very difficult for me to say how much because it's a case-by-case kind of question. You need to experiment with it. I would say if you're starting out, put somewhere between 10 to 15% more water in, but do start with less rather than more because, you know, you can add more water. Sometimes it's slightly more difficult to do that when the bread's more fully formed, but you can. You can't take that water away though. Although you can save that loaf if it's too overhydrated, you can put it in a tin and it'll still taste great. So it might take you a few goes to understand, okay, this is how much more water my flour needs. Now I'm milling it at home in my mock mill rather than this is how much my shop-bought flour used. Each time you do it, write it down because, I mean, I always forget to write it down. I guess you're like that, Andrea, too. You do something and you're like, well, oh, I don't know how I did it. I can't remember how much I put in. I just put a teaspoon more.
That was really good.
Yeah, exactly. So each time you do it, make an effort to say, right, I used, I don't know, 10% more water. And it still was a bit kind of hard when I was trying to stretch and fold it. So maybe I'll try.
That's for your food scale.
10%. Yeah, exactly. I should take note of it myself and do it more often because I don't.
You are a strong advocate for using a food scale in the kitchen because of things like this, right?
Yeah.
How do you know if you're just eyeballing it that you did 10%?
You don't. But I think
it's on a scale.
You know, baking is an art, but it is a science too. And if we can just make those science bits down pat and have scales to test them and write them down, then we can express ourselves through the art of baking rather than messing up through the science.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you. I love baking. So the other thing about your freshly milled flour is I would say that it's a weaker flour generally than the shop-bought flour because the gluten is less developed. Flour that is left on a shelf, the gluten becomes more developed. I can't think of a better word, pronounced. So that's not a problem if you're making something like rye, of course, because rye doesn't rely on a gluten network to rise. But if you are baking with a bread that predominantly does rely on a gluten network to rise, like wheat, you might need to work that dough more in order to develop that gluten, which is weaker in freshly milled flour. You also could potentially do an autolyse on the flour, which will hydrate it more fully. That's basically just mixing your flour and your water together and leaving it. And that then might help you as you start to bring the dough together with all the other ingredients. The third.
Is that what that word means?
Yeah, it does. It's a posh word for a really simple process. It's just you put your water with your flour.
Hydration.
And you leave it. Yeah. Basically. It's hydrating your flour. So it's fully hydrated because some flours take longer to hydrate and some bread processes benefit from having a flour that's more fully hydrated. And so you can just leave your flour and your water literally overnight. Sometimes I leave mine in the fridge. And very often then when you take it out, it's like a fully formed dough. So I'll literally spread my sourdough starter and my salt on it as a dough and then start to fold it in and roll it together and work it and work it and work it that way rather than putting everything all at once. Yeah, that's the autolyse. Okay. Last thing about freshly milled flour is it will probably be more active. And I'm not sure of the science on this, whether more kind of goodies in the fermentation stay on the grain rather than being lost when it's ground. But you will probably have to watch your fermentation. Whole grain bread can be more active anyway because a lot of the goodies are on the bran, but freshly milled whole grain bread particularly can be extremely active. So make sure when you're doing that swap to start with that you're watching your fermentation, because it's probably going to over ferment rather than under ferment if you don't. So yeah, those are the main differences between home mill flour and shop bought flour. What we're going to do is the patron question, which we can't squeeze in here because we're at the hour, which was, how can I convert recipes I see online for bread flour to use my whole grain flour? We will, after we've stopped recording, we will continue and make an after show addressing that question. And so if you would like to get access to that and all of our other after shows, and come join us on Discord, which is wonderful, and access our private podcast, you can come join us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/ancestral kitchen podcast. Okay, any questions before I wrap up, Andrea?
Wow, I just love it all. And I don't know. I've been so fascinated watching Ellie and then now watching you. Mm. And you know, I have an old mill.
Yes.
But I know now. I mean, I knew before that it got the flour pretty hot. So I don't know what type of mill it is. Mm. I could probably look it up. Still probably better than a store bought one that was also heated.
Mm.
But I also know it doesn't get it very fine.
Okay.
And that's always kind of an irritation when I'm baking and makes it less everybody's favorite. So I'm thinking now that, you know, getting a better mill will probably be a part of our journey.
Mm.
And I am just glad I don't need to go research all the brands because you did it for me.
Yeah. You know, I kind of, I give credit to Ellie there because, you know, she did the original research and I love what she's up to and what she does. And it was her.
She is as deep dive as you.
Exactly. I knew. Like you said about me, you know, you feel like you can trust me and the research that I've done. I feel the same about Ellie. And so when the question came up as to what mill I was going to get, you know, when I realized that this was the time and I wanted to, then really there wasn't any question in my head because I knew that I wanted a mock mill because I'd seen Ellie do what she's done with it. And I know the research she put into it. And, you know, I did do the research and I looked at Como and I looked at mock mill and I looked at other mills and she's right. And I have not looked back. I mean, I have not regretted that purchase for a moment.
No, you rave to me about it all the time. Yeah. So I know that you love this new little companion in your kitchen.
I do. I do.
And it's something, grain touches a lot of aspects of yours and my meals.
Yeah.
Like it turns up in a lot of places. So I feel like if there is somewhere to kind of spend a little dough, to use a grain pun, it would be on this.
I think that pun was so great. We may have to title the episode with it. Okay. Yeah,
well, thank you, Allison, for all your intensive research and also reaching out to Mockmill to get us the connection with them and everything. This is phenomenal.
Yeah, indeed.
I have learned a lot today.
Wonderful. I'm really glad. And I hope that the listeners have too. Do reach out to me if you're listening and you have questions. You know, I'm sure we're going to do more episodes on bread and milling and flour and everything in the future. So do feel free.
You should probably... Mm. We, Allison, sometimes, you know, these episodes end up sparking more conversation in the Discord. So what I should do is going to make a thread.
Yeah.
For the episode, because some of these like super specific episodes are really good to have a thread on. And then everybody who has mills
can come and comment
in there and comment
and ask questions. Yeah, so I agree. So yeah, if you're thinking about it, I would totally recommend home milling. Like I said, I haven't regretted the mock mill purchase at all. I just absolutely love it. And if you want to, do use our links. It won't cost you any more, but you'll be helping us continue to get in your ears and bring this podcast to you. Thank you very much, Andrea.
All right, next time, Allison.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks Thank you so much for listening. We'd love to continue the conversation. Come find us on Instagram. Andrea's at farmandhearth and Alison's at ancestral_kitchen. Until next time, we both wish you much fun, exploration and satisfaction in and out of the kitchen.